All right, everybody, welcome to Children of the Void. I'm Morgan Rector, and my co-host is Bonnie Lee. And today we're featuring a case that has always been wrapped in mystery. For one thing, the child whose name is Joseph Augustus Zorelli was missing for many decades. Well, actually, he wasn't missing, but they didn't know what his identity was. They didn't know what his name was. That was true for decades. And they finally found out what his name is in 2022, but they still don't know what happened to him. They still don't know what his roots are, his parents are. Still a big mystery. So I'm gonna go through the story here. So yes, he was known for being he received two monikers by the media. One was the boy in the box. And the other one is America's Unknown Child. Excuse me. And the reason he was called the boy in the box is because of the way he was found. He was his body was found in a box, and he was naked and extensively beaten on the side of Susquehanna. I don't know if I'm pronouncing this properly. Susquehanna Road in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. On February 25th, 1957, it's funny because he was. It says that he was, he was cleaned and groomed and had a haircut and his fingernail. Everything was trim and clean, and yet he was also subjected to a very severe physical assault before he died. There were bruises on his body. He was also starved. He was scrawny, clear. It was obvious he was malnourished. There were scars all over his body. And they said they were surgical. So they were deep wounds on his ankle, groin, and chin. And the police believe that the cause of death was homicide by blunt force trauma. And this case received a lot of attention at the time. But despite all the exposure and interest, which has attracted throughout the years off and on, his identity was unknown, as I said before, for decades, until just a few months ago on November 30th, 2022, very recently, the Philadelphia Police Department announced that they found his identity using DNA and genealogical databases. So on December 8th, 2022, more than 65 years after his body was found, the boy was publicly identified as Joseph Augustus Zorelli in a press conference thrown by Philadelphia Police Department. And a description of the crime scene. So way back in February 25th, 1957, his body was wrapped in a plaid blanket. Was found in the woods off of Susquehanna Road in Fox Chase, Philadelphia. The body was discovered by a young man who was checking his musket traps, and fearing that the police would confiscate his traps, he didn't report what he found. So a few days later, a college student spotted a rabbit running into the underbrush, and figuring that there were animal traps in the area, he stopped his car to investigate and discovered Zorelli's body there. This guy was also reluctant to contact the police, but he did report what he found the following day. After all, if you find a dead body and you don't report it, doesn't that sound suspicious?
Yeah, I get the two boys and the situations mixed up a little bit, but I know one of them, his family had only been in the United States for less than a month. They had come from Poland, and I think they were nervous about, I think this was John, the young boy. They were nervous about just the police in general. They just didn't have a trust for going to them. So they kind of didn't want to get accused or wrapped into it by coming forward. I guess they thought maybe that their son would be blamed for it. And they were just kind of unsure about really dealing with the police as well. And then I think the other boy was the one that people thought was maybe a little being a little sort of shy to come forward because he was possibly being sort of voyeuristic with some watching some girls that were attending the Sisters of Good Shepherd School. It's a wayward girls' home.
Oh, yeah.
And so there was no real, I think, you know, proof of that or anything, but it was something that they speculated that, you know, he felt kind of embarrassed maybe to come forward admitting what he was doing over there. So,
yeah, I suppose that maybe that's something that happens a lot where people are just, right. They're thinking, what are the cops going to think of the fact that I found a body that nobody else found for a long time and it was in a very difficult, it was a spot that's very difficult to find and, you know, how convenient that I happened to find it.
Yeah.
So I suppose a lot of people would have that thought. So, yeah, his naked body was inside of a cardboard box that had once contained a bassinet of the kind sold by JCPenney. His hair had been recently cropped, as I mentioned, possibly after death, as clumps of his hair clung to his body. There were signs of severe malnourishment, as previously mentioned, and surgical scars on the ankle and groin. There was also an L-shaped scar under the chin. So the police issued a sort of bulletin to the community, and it's kind of morbid actually, because they took photos of the dead child and they put it on the bulletin. I mean, then it wasn't an artist rendering. I mean, these were pictures of a dead child. It's really kind of disturbing, but yeah, they put that in the community, and no one came forward, which suggests to me that it must have been a homicide, because I mean, when you consider the way he was left and no one came forward, mm-hmm. obviously, and if he died from blunt force trauma, couldn't have been anything else. So moving forward, I'm going through the other photos, because they included them all, you know, head to toe.
Didn't they also take a couple of photos where they dressed him up and had him sitting up to try to jog people's memories of, you know, what this young boy would have looked like had they seen him in his average everyday dress? So they had him in like kind of little dress pants and
they
had
might
him sitting up. Yeah, but they also released photos that were more, you know, well, I don't know if it's more morbid or less morbid, but also morbid, just of him, you know, nude with showing his bruises. So it was kind of unusual thing, I think. But I know in the old days, people would do stuff like that. They would like dress up the body and take photos to remember them.
But yeah. That was something unusual that they did in the Victorian era a lot. They would, right after someone would die, they would bring a photographer in, take a picture of the dead person with their family, and then put it back in the coffin. So maybe because that they remembered that so recently that they didn't find this disturbing at all.
Yeah, it's possible. I don't know. I just found that kind of disturbing when I was looking through different photos. I was kind of that actually kind of was more shocking to me than the other photos, because I was like, well, why did they dress him up and try to make him look like he's sitting somewhere on the couch, like relaxing? It was kind of morbid. But yeah. I guess they figured it might help people remember if they saw him more as he was when he was alive. I'm not sure.
Yeah, and the police took his fingerprints, and they figured after that someone would come forward. But nope, no one came forward. So the case attracted considerable media attention in Philadelphia and the Delaware Valley. The Philadelphia Inquirer printed 400,000 flyers depicting the boy's likeness, which were sent out and posted across the area and were included with every gas bill in Philadelphia. So there's no way that nobody in that area wouldn't have been aware of the missing child. The crime scene was combed over and over again by 270 police academy recruits who discovered a man's blue corduroy cap, a child's scarf, and a man's white handkerchief with the letter G in the corner. But all these clues led to nowhere. The police also distributed a post-mortem photograph of the boy fully dressed, as you just mentioned, and in a seated position, as he may have looked in life, in the hope that it might lead to a clue. The next major event was in 1998. His body was exhumed for the purpose of extracting DNA, which is obtained from a tooth. On March 21st, 2016, the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children released a forensic facial reconstruction of the victim and added him into their database. The bottom was then exhumed yet again in 2019 to retrieve additional DNA samples. He was an unidentified murder victim for decades. However, on November 30th, 2022, the Philadelphia Police Department announced that they had identified the child through the use of genetic testing and investigative genetic genealogy, and that they would provide a case update in the following week. Sources stated that he was the child of a prominent family in Delaware County, Pennsylvania. That's surprising because, you know, usually when children are killed and dumped, like, I think it's often when it's like a child who was born out of wedlock or something, that was like their way of like just, you know, avoiding the stigma. So it's odd that he would be cast out like that from a well-to-do family, isn't it?
Yeah, or people struggling with poverty maybe don't really want to go to, say, the orphanage or whatever. Maybe they would find, you know, if they were abusing him, it's better to just discard of the body. I don't know. It's just, it was kind of surprising.
Yeah, it's like I saw these pictures from the Great Depression where a woman was selling her children, but it was nothing like that. And but they didn't kill the children, they just sold them.
Right.
So, authorities said that the investigation will use this new information to continue to search for suspects. They must be dead. I mean, that happened so long ago. I mean, if they're alive, they'd be pretty decrepit by now, I think.
Mm-hmm.
On December 8, 2022, the child was publicly identified as 4-year-old Joseph Augustus Zarelli, born on January 13, 1953. Genealogists had uncovered his name more than a year earlier in October 2021. On January 19, 2023, the names of Zarelli's parents were reported. Investigators were finally able to identify him after a cousin uploaded DNA to a public database. Investigators subsequently encouraged that person's mother, a first cousin of Zarelli, to submit a genetic profile to GED Match, which she did, allowing investigators to identify his parents. A court order for the child's birth certificate was then made, which revealed the child's name and his parents' names, subsequently verified by DNA. So there were some theories that were advanced prior to the identification. There was one involving a foster home that was located approximately 1.5 miles from the site of the body. In 1960, Remington Bristow, an employee of the medical examiner's office, who doggedly pursued the case until his death in 1993, contacted a New Jersey psychic who told him to look for a house that matched the foster home. And the psychic was brought to the Philadelphia Discovery site. She led Bristow directly to the foster home. Upon attending an estate sale at the foster home, Bristow discovered a bassinet similar to the one sold at JCPenney. He also discovered blankets hanging on the clothesline that were similar to the one in which the boy's body had been wrapped when they discovered him. Bristow believed that the boy belonged to the stepdaughter of the man who ran the foster home, and that they disposed of his body so the stepdaughter would not be exposed as an unwed mother. So that sounds pretty plausible. That so he was married to her mother and then possibly sexually abused her, and they wanted to keep that quiet, so they got rid of the child. Seems likely to me. However, the police had established that all the foster children were accounted for, and a re-examination by police investigators confirmed that the family were likely not involved. In 1998, Philadelphia Police Lieutenant Tom Augustin, who was in charge of the investigation, and several members of the Vidocq Society, a group of retired policemen and profilers, interviewed the foster father and the stepdaughter, whom he had married. The foster home investigation was closed. Well, it's not like they're going to admit it if they're being interviewed about it.
Yeah, I think the is it I think it's the VDOC Society.
VDOC, and, yeah, it's spelled that way, yeah.
Yeah, I think it is the VDOC Society, and they're kind of involved with a lot of cases that are unsolved, and they kind of have like the best of the best getting together and kind of putting their heads together to solve different sort of, I don't want to say famous crimes, but, you know, some that are in the more forefront unsolved crimes.
Are they located like across the United States? Is that a really big organization?
I think it's a big organization, and the people involved are all over internationally, but they meet at the society, you know, every once in a while, and they'll just kind of reminds me of Mensa. I think they all kind of sit around deciding which cases they're going to look at that time, and then they just start picking it apart, and they just use all of the talent in the room to try to get, you know, down to the bottom of the case. But they don't always, you know, figure it out right away. Sometimes it takes time. But yeah, it's kind of made up of different people that are FBI agents or previous investigators, detectives. It's just comprised of all kinds of different people. They probably have forensic experts, things like that. And they sort of get together kind of all the great minds and put together, you know, their biggest theories of the case or even trying to solve a case. So getting them involved in a case is probably the most likely way that an unsolved case that old could be solved. So
yeah, there are detectives who really, you know, get, they only really in some cases latch onto a case and they never really forget about it and become obsessed and pursue it years after it goes cold.
So
I guess a lot of those people end up joining organizations like that.
Absolutely, I'm sure. Yeah,
because every case basically has a budget, and if you exceed the budget, then they don't want you to invest any more manpower into it, but
But there's still these people with the will to solve it. So yeah, that's exactly what ends up happening. I think even in this case, I believe there was an investigator who was actually a medical examiner's office employee, Remington Bristow. He was one of the people that just wouldn't let it go. I think he was the one who kind of sought out Florence, the psychic.
Oh, yeah.
Because he just didn't want the case to just sort of, you know, fall away. And so he was open-minded to anything at that point. He just wanted anything that would maybe lead to something. So,
yeah, it was interesting because I've been watching, I have Amazon Prime. I've been watching like the original Unsolved Mysteries. They have the whole series.
Oh, yeah. Aren't they great?
Yeah, all the Robert Stack episodes. And yeah, they were talking about how some cases they brought psychics on board. And sometimes they are real. They are exact. Sometimes they are right.
There's actually, there's one case that I always remember because I guess we get a little bit jaded reading about so many different true crime cases. And then you hear sort of some of the horror stories where someone has a missing child and then all of these people kind of come out of the woodwork phoning them and kind of bothering them and saying, oh, he's in water or he's been murdered or he's still alive, and giving them false hope about different things. But I remember hearing about a case actually here in Manitoba. It was a lady, well, she was a teenager, and she was murdered up north in Manitoba. And it's one of the more famous cases for the missing and murdered Indigenous women movement that's happening. Yeah. It was one of the earlier cases because the whole town, all of the white people in town kind of gathered together and kept the secret. They just had this sort of silence about the group of guys that they knew had murdered her. And it was kind of a case that still gets talked about here a lot. And everybody here kind of remembers her for that because it was just so horrible how things shook out with that. But one of the things that gave away one of the four people was that they had one of the witnesses, they brought them in, and they had several people had agreed to, but one of them remembered something, and so they had someone come in and hypnotize everyone. And you kind of think, oh, whatever. You know, you think, oh, I don't know about hypnotizing. You're not going to solve a case with that. But one of the people under hypnosis was able to recall the partial plate that was on the vehicle they saw pulling her into the car. And so that led them to one of the offenders. So sometimes when you go through these cases, it's really interesting how things that often you go, you know, goofy, you know, stuff. There are times where they do find good leads from people that are psychics or, you know, hypnotists or whatever. They'll find information through those means sometimes. But then you hear of so many other times where they actually kind of mess up the investigation or even make things kind of feel more torturous for the victims' families.
Yeah, like with Sylvia Brown.
Yeah. I was thinking about her.
There's a montage of clips of her from like Montel Williams where she made all these predictions, maybe on other shows too. And thing is, they were all so off the mark. Like,
yeah, like just for wrong. Instance,
yeah, like saying you should invest in the stock market in 2008. Well, that was the year when the economy went into the shitter, right? So. So yeah, she was
making like a lot of money from books and appearances on TV shows and things like that. And then there were so many examples where she was just wrong.
Oh yeah, way off the mark. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Also, there was some things that, I mean, you couldn't really prove she was wrong, but it was particularly disturbing. She would have an audience of people, say on Montel or something, and someone would ask her about a family member, and then she would kind of interpret information or messages from people that had passed away that they wanted to give to their family members. And then the people would just be really overwhelmed and overcome with hearing these messages. And you just knew that she was just making it up.
Oh, yeah,
so,
yeah.
It seems so sick, you know. it was really disgusting.
Yeah, it didn't seem like she was trying. She was just kind of making it up as she was going along.
Yeah. Anyway, sorry, I kind of went on a tangent with
that. No, that's all right. No, tangents are good as long as they're relevant, right? Yeah. So there's this whole issue of a woman known as Martha, or M, just the initial M. So one theory that was brought forward in February 2002. Was a woman identified only as Martha or M accusing her mother of acquiring and killing the child. Police considered her story to be plausible, but were troubled by her testimony as she had a history of mental illness. She said her mother and father purchased Joseph from his birth parents in the summer of 1954, after which he was beaten to death and his body left abandoned inside a box outside of town. Police were unable to verify her story. Neighbors who had access to Martha's house during the stated time period denied that there had been a young boy living there and dismissed Martha's claims as ridiculous. Well, maybe so, but I mean, if she was abused badly enough, maybe that caused a mental illness. And
that's right.
If her parents were capable of, you know, beating and murdering a child, maybe they messed her up, you know.
That's right. Before when I kind of took us off on a little tangent, I just wanted to bring it back around to the fact that I believe they did use DNA testing in 2007 and ruled out the stepdaughter as the mother of the young boy from the foster home.
Yeah.
They actually did rule that out completely. So that lead or that belief, it was kind of ruled out. And I think I interrupted you before you got to that
comment. Oh yeah.
I apologize. I just want to make sure that people know that theory was ruled out with DNA. So, and then I guess that's when they kind of started looking at this other lady and her daughter. So I don't know if the claim, I don't know why they called it ridiculous, because her story didn't sound ridiculous.
Well, there's a lot of very interesting theories. One of them was advanced by forensic artist Frank Bender, and his theory is that the victim may have been raised as a girl. The child's unprofessional haircut, which appeared to have been performed in haste, was the basis for this scenario, as well as the appearance of the eyebrows, which appeared to have been styled. I mean, since when would they pluck a little boy's eyebrows, right?
Yeah.
I mean, well, I don't know if they did to little girls either, but In 2008, Bender released a sketch of the unidentified child with long hair reflecting the strands found on his body. So that's an interesting theory.
He could have had a loss of some of his eyebrows just from being malnourished.
Sometimes
that will be a sort of a side effect of being malnourished. You'll lose hair.
There
could be other reasons that his eyebrows look like that. But that was an interesting theory as well. I kind of thought that was interesting. Yeah, maybe he was living as a girl, because that would make it less likely people would be able to think back and go, oh yeah, they did have a son. Where did he go? If he was actually raised, you know, with people believing he was female. So that's interesting as well.
Yeah, I think like anorexics, like as their bodies shut down from starvation, hair starts to fall out. And
And the stress also of the abuse would make you lose your hair. So it's so sad, but it's definitely something that could have been the reason, as opposed to just that they had him dressed as a girl. But it's an interesting theory.
Well, you know, the stress of abuse, it causes the chemical cortisone to be secreted in excess quantities, and that actually affects the immune system.
Yeah.
Where it just isn't able to deflect, you know, impurities as well. Mm-hmm. It weakens the body, and so that might have had something to do with the hair loss as well.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
In 2016, two writers, one from Los Angeles and the other from New Jersey, believed they had discovered a potential identity from Memphis, Tennessee, and requested that DNA be compared between the family members and the child. The lead was originally discovered by a Philadelphia man who introduced Romano and Hoffman to each other, the two people, and was developed and presented with the help of Hoffman to the Philadelphia Police Department and the VDOC Society in early 2013. In December 2013, Romano became aware of the lead and agreed to help the man from Philadelphia and Hoffman to obtain the DNA from this particular family member in January 2014, which was sent quickly to the Philadelphia Police Department. Local authorities confirmed that they would investigate the lead, but said they would need to do more research on the circumstances surrounding the link to Memphis before comparing the DNA. In December 2017, Homicide Sergeant Bob Kohlmeyer confirmed that DNA taken from the Memphis man was compared to the Fox Chase boy, and there was no connection. So another
dead end.
Yeah. It sucks when I'm investigating like human monsters, and I can go through like a book, and there could be like 20, 30 pages describing like a lead that went nowhere. And I'm
and
like,
it's nothing.
I'm like, this is a waste of time. I'm not going to include this.
Cause it just didn't go anywhere. The only time I find it can be interesting is if it in part of the story, you know, especially if it's a long case, sometimes it can kind of highlight the different people that get involved with, you know, with a case that it's completely unintentional and they really don't have anything to do with it. And they're just kind of wrapped into it. So like, it can be interesting, but man, that can be frustrating too. If you think if this has goes nowhere. So I don't think people really want to hear all the details of it. So.
Well, it's interesting sometimes when the perpetrator gets away with something for like a long, long time, mm-hmm. where you're like, how the hell did they not catch them? Mm-hmm. Like Paul Bernardo, basically it took years for them to finally nail him. It was like.
Yeah. And he wasn't particularly cautious. Mm-hmm. Like he was jumping out of his car, grabbing people from the bus stop, you know, or walking down the street. I think he talked about this last time, but I think it was just the different jurisdictions just refused to work together. So he just kind of ran amok.
Yeah. And also. I don't know if it's still true, but back then, in the 80s and the 90s, the process of analyzing DNA and coming up with a match, it took forever, and there was mm-hmm. usually a backlog because they just didn't invest a lot of money in this process. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that's one thing that time was on his side because of that, because it took years for them to finally analyze the samples that he gave.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember that. Yeah, it's kind of DNA is like the thing that is kind of saving everybody right now. 'Cause this case is also similar to another case that I didn't even realize they had solved. I guess it was in March last year, and it was a young girl who in the 60s disappeared. Her name was Sharon Lee. I think I believe it's Gallegos, and she was actually called Little Miss Nobody. And again, genetic testing kind of led them to the right, information to identify her. So it's like these things are decades and decades later. So imagine if you know they're coming for me, you know that the more and more people that are submitting their their little sample to find out a little bit about their history and the makeup of their genetics, and just gonna you're waiting for that one auntie or uncle to just ruin it all for you,
Yeah,
and then you're caught.
exactly. Yeah, there's a lot of missing person cases in the unsolved mysteries, and they have found a lot of them. But it's like it seems like after a while, you could at least a woman could get paranoid because there's so many segments that start with she left for work and was never
Yeah,
seen again.
that's right. It doesn't pick you right up off the street. It is. It's
Yeah,
terrifying.
and in many cases, some of them never were seen ever again. Yeah, one guy's wife, they found the guy who kidnapped her, but they never found her, which is
Yeah,
kind of creepy, yeah.
that's awful, eh? Well,
Yeah.
it's interesting too, because in this case, you kind of touched on this, but I think we're just about to get back there again. The fellow, Justin Thomas, he had purchased the DNA testing kit. It was a gift for his girlfriend. And then she dumped him. And he figured, well, I guess I'll use it. We'll see what happens. And that was how somehow it pinged this place called Identifier International. And then they contacted him and said that he was a partial match for a cold case in Philadelphia. So that's, a pretty good example of someone who's just inadvertently, they're finding themselves dragged into the situation that they had no idea that they were involved in. And so it was kind of interesting that, he decided to do the test. If his girlfriend had stayed with him, then she would have used it. Maybe this wouldn't have been a solved case yet.
Yeah, I wonder, now they have these COVID tests you can do at home. Maybe someday there will be DNA tests you can do at home.
That's right.
It's like a home.
It's pretty crazy.
It could be as convenient as like a home pregnancy test. You can just,
Yeah.
lead
Or
in
if
wherever.
the police are investigating someone and they do have DNA to match to, instead of trying to get your straw or your cigarette butt, they can just come up and, scan your retina or something, and just your DNA information will just pop up, bleep, bleep, bloop, and that's it.
Oh yeah, totally.
Yeah. Anyway, sorry, I kind of
No,
threw you
it's
off
okay.
on a little
So
tangent there again.
it's all right. Just last month, NBC 10 Philadelphia reported that Joseph was born to a couple that lived at 64th and Callow Hill, although the channel stated it was, quote, unclear if he lived there long enough for people to even notice him. And in the same month, the Philadelphia Inquirer reported that Joseph's biological parents were Augustus J. Zarelli, known as Gus, and Mary Elizabeth Plunkett, known as Betsy. So it's interesting she didn't have the same surname. So that must it must have had something to do with him having been born out of wedlock.
Yes, and I
So.
think the testing, I think, came back. They gave Justin Thomas and one of his siblings the name, saying, this young boy, his name is Joseph Augustus Zarelli. That was what the match was for. And he thought that was interesting because he knew his grandmother's family were Zarellis. So they had his mother do some testing as well. And then they revealed that his mother was a first cousin of the boy. So it's so confusing. His grandma was a sibling of the maternal parent of the boy in the box. So that's how they discovered who his father is. So his mother was deceased. They didn't say his father's deceased. And he had three siblings, but there's I'm not sure if all three of them, if this is the same situation, but they said he has three siblings. Some are living, and he has living half siblings on both sides. So that might have been why they needed his mother's DNA, because he had half siblings on both sides. So the mixture is like, even my little brain, I can't even figure out how that would work. But he did have, I guess, siblings after his parents, I guess, each split up and had other children with other people. So,
yeah.
But didn't you think it's interesting? It's so silly. It's probably not connected at all, but it just kind of caught my eye that when they revealed the names of the parents and they said that his father was known as Gus, it right away made me think of how they found that hanky by the boy's body that had a G embolized on it.
Yeah.
I wonder if his father brought him out into the, you know, into the bush. But I mean, that's really just a grasping at straws, I guess. But I just thought it was interesting that his father was known as Gus, so he likely would have just used that as his, you know, moniker on his hanky.
Well, I mean, you know, kids born out of wedlock and foster kids, I mean, when they are abused, it's always heinous. It's always just unbelievably brutal. I mean, this kid, I mean, starved him. They beat him up, just wounds up and down his body. Mm-hmm. I mean, they really did a number on him. And it's, I mean, I don't know. I mean, at least it would have been humane if they had just, you know, shot him execution style. Mm-hmm. And just turn his lights out. But yeah. I mean, this was really sadistic. I mean, it's reminiscent of like what's the famous Netflix series, the Hispanic boy, Gabriel Fernandez.
Oh yeah. Oh, that was horrible.
Yeah. Or the one I did, Terrell Peterson, how the way they treated him. I mean, that boy was, you know, rooting through garbage cans looking for things to eat because he was being starved.
Mm-hmm.
There's something about, you know, children born out of wedlock and foster kids where I don't know why people treat them so poorly in some conditions. I mean, I am aware, as far as the whole step parent abuse thing, there is a phenomenon that the psychiatric community calls the Cinderella effect, mm-hmm. where basically the step parent resents that they're having to take care of another person's offspring. And so back when we were apes, they would chase the offspring off or kill them and then just raise their own. So maybe there is still an instinct in the human race to treat, you know, stepchildren mm-hmm. and foster children and children born out of wedlock in a very abusive way to reject them.
Mm. Well, here's an interesting one for you too. It's like Manitoba, it's the most awful place sometimes with the cases.
It's
that
a
we
violent
hear,
place, isn't it?
It's really scary. But that one case, interesting sort of connection there with what you're talking about is the case of Phoenix Sinclair, who was a little girl who was living with her mother, and her mother split up with her biological father, and she had hitched up with this other fellow who had a good job, but they both, you know, they drank a lot and stuff. There's sort of conditions that exist sometimes for people who are in poverty, and especially Indigenous people here in Manitoba. There's a long history that adds to situations where when you hear about things that are, you know, people are charged with or that have happened, you think, well, how can that ever be going on? But it's years and years and years of, I guess, you know, like racism, straight up racism. And you know, these things can happen. But this particular case was so bad because it was actually the maternal parent that was abusing the little girl. And so she didn't want to feed her, and her boyfriend would say, you know, why don't you, you know, give her a bath? Why don't you take her out. Why are you not feeding her enough? And why aren't you nice to that little girl? And he would go shopping and then come and visit because he didn't live with her. And he would bring food so that the little girl would have food. And he would try to kind of help out and make things easier. But she just abused the poor little girl for so long. And then Child and Family Services had come to the home to see the child. And she would always make up some reason or not answer the door. And so they weren't diligent enough to follow up. And so she did pass away. And then her and this boyfriend, they were so afraid of getting caught. So they buried the little girl out in the, you know, it was in the woods somewhere out back. And eventually he felt so guilty that he agreed to show the police where the baby was buried. Well, she wasn't really a baby, more like a toddler. And he was the one that seemed to sort of have the most remorse and be the most kind of horrified by what had happened. And it's kind of unusual because usually, like you said, it would be the maternal parent would be the less likely one to be abusing the child. But the abuse that little girl went through was absolutely horrible because unlike this case, she had several broken bones that had healed over or whatever. Jeez. And so it was really horrible, like really horrible treatment. But the ones that ended up getting the most exposure was the Child and Family Services and how they let this little girl sort of slip through the cracks. And it became a touchstone case for a lot of people that she wasn't safe at home with her mother.
Oh yeah. Well, I mean, abuse is pretty widespread in those communities. Sexual abuse, physical abuse, which dovetails a lot with the substance abuse. Mm-hmm. And I'm certainly not that it's an excuse, but there is a part of Canada's history is these residential schools where Aboriginal children were taken. They were stripped of their culture. They were forced to learn English. And while during their time there, as if that wasn't traumatic enough in terms of being separated from their families, they were abused in every which way. And people who were abused as children, they tend to, unfortunately, in many cases, you know, visit that upon their own children. And so that's making its rounds throughout those communities. Who knows how long it'll take to be filtered out, but yeah, there's a lot of abuse going on. And
Well, I guess that's like the expression. I don't know if you hear people say this, but hurt people hurt people. And
yeah,
it just goes down in through generations. I mean, also you see something as normalized because it occurs, you know, you see a lot of, especially on the reservations, you know, if you're just seeing a lot of drinking and a lot of, you know, this and that or abuse, it becomes normalized. But it's really, really a complicated scenario. And I hate even analyzing it because I just know that I don't really understand it enough to explain it or to understand it. But it is absolutely something that I think will take generations to correct. And when you see situations like what happened with Phoenix Sinclair, it just reminds you of how actually urgent it is. To make sure, like I was saying, that the hurt people get the help they need before they hurt other people.
So, oh yeah. Well, yeah. Scientists have found that trauma actually changes your DNA. It changes your genes, which would explain why. Yeah, a lot of people who have been through trauma end up like they're never really happy. They have emotional problems all their lives. Many struggle with substance abuse, and then. And because abuse was normalized in their childhood, they may end up, lashing out against their own children. So yeah, right. it's something that can absolutely change you at the metabolical level.
Yeah, which is so awful when you think about the effects that abuse has on everybody, but specifically children in this case. To know that abuse actually runs so deeply that it becomes part of their genetics. the trauma of it is just makes it all that more difficult to understand how people abuse young children, and it's really sad. It's really sad. And I think that's why so many people found this case, the boy in the box case, and so moving, and why it was never really forgotten, because the idea of a young boy being shoved into a box and left out in the bush somewhere with no one claiming him, and it just seems like the worst case scenario you could imagine for a young child, to just be abused until they pass away and then they don't even have a name.
Yeah.
So it's just, I think that's why so many people had this case on their mind over all these decades.
And the fact that the perpetrators were never brought to justice, that's a whole other outrage right there.
Absolutely. And that's the funny thing. When I was going through this this case and reading up on it, I kind of had to remind myself, getting to the end of the information, yes, they've identified him and they've identified members of his family, but they haven't actually identified who is responsible for his death and who brought him out into the woods. And it's not a closed case. It's still very open. And so it'll be interesting to see in the future what else comes forward.
Yeah. I mean, back then it really was a scandalous thing to be born out of wedlock. Like my father was, and my grandmother would not tell him or anybody who his father was. She took that information to the grave.
Oh,
I remember reading Jack Nicholson grew up thinking that his mother was actually his older sister, and then we only found out as an adult she was his mother.
That's right. I only found that out recently. I didn't know that. Apparently that was a few years ago, but he was older when he found that out. So that would be really upsetting.
Oh yeah, I think he might have been in his like 30s or something.
Yeah.
Wasn't that a big part of Ted Bundy's life story? He was born out of wedlock, wasn't he?
Actually, there's a couple. There was Ted Bundy. He thought that his mom was his mom, but it was his sister, I believe. No.
Oh yeah.
He thought who he thought was his sister was his mother.
Yeah. So yeah, a similar situation. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think Bernardo was the same thing. I think Bernardo.
He was led to believe that. Is the man who, well, Kenneth Bernardo he was told he was his father, but he was actually his stepfather, his real father. He never met. He was his
mother. And then his mom would call him names all the time and stuff like that.
Call him a bastard, yeah.
Yeah. And then it ended up getting even more morose, because then as she kind of started slipping more mentally and physically, him and his father would start calling her names.
Oh yeah,
well, so sick. They just mistreated her so badly as well.
Yeah, she played a big role in planting the seeds of his misogyny. Mm-hmm. You know, he ended
up hated women, which is so funny, because Carla was the opposite. Her family was really the most all American, I say, even though they were Canadian, but just, they were just the most nuclear family, normal, everybody had good jobs. They were all treated well. And there wasn't all that kind of crazy weirdness going on in her home. And yet she was so attracted to him, just immediately, couldn't even see straight, was just so attracted to him.
Oh, yeah.
And the more that she gained insight into how messed up he was, it was like the more that she had to be with him.
Well, yeah,
it didn't scare her away. It drew her in further.
Well, I mean, yeah, it's not something that just developed when she met him. Like, she went through a phase where she was like wearing all black, kind of a goth thing, and and then so when they met, it's like sometimes couples can have the wrong things in common, and it turned out that they had this dark side when it came to sexuality, and so that they came together, and she encouraged that in him.
Yeah, it's like she was kind of like the cheerleader,
Oh, totally,
but,
yeah.
at the time that they met, I think she was in her phase of like glamorous girl. They had their group of friends used to call themselves the Diamond Club or something. And they were always talking about how they were going to marry rich men and have a nice house and dress really nice and have lots of nice jewelry and stuff. And so I guess when she saw Bernardo and he was working with an accounting firm and he seemed successful, he had that 80s, you know, driven attitude with the short blonde hair, kind of looked like a really successful business type. And I think it was exactly what she was looking for.
Oh, yeah.
But then when he kind of showed some of his darker side, I think she was like even more in, which is really weird because she did not come from a home where those things were normalized. So I don't know. Something clicked with those two that I think was like a chemical reaction that no one can explain.
Well, there's quite a lot in the episode of Human Monsters about him that would gross people out. But one thing I learned only after doing it, and it's unfortunate that I couldn't include this, but he got her to prove her love for him by eating his feces.
Oh, yeah. I remember hearing that.
Yeah. So there's pretty much nothing she wouldn't do.
No. So. Like, honestly, like, where is the line where you say, I think I'm going to leave? You know?
maybe that was the litmus test where he was going to try to find out, like, would she be willing to hand her sister over to me? And I have to find a way to prove to myself through her willingness if she'll do that. So
there, yeah. And it does create this element of, I know when I covered that case, I had a lot of people comment back saying, oh, wow, I never thought I would ever hear a podcaster do coverage of, you know, Carla and have it sympathetic to her. And I thought, but it wasn't. It wasn't.
I got that accusation, too.
Yeah, where people were saying, why? Well, you know, it seemed like you were kind of sympathetic to her. But I was only... you know, just to be fair and forward and sharing all of the information, it was a fact that he was abusing her, that she was coerced. And there was absolutely elements of that. And that was in no way to say that she was absolved of her responsibility in any of her behaviors because they were horrible. But she also was abused and, coerced. So it's really tricky. That case itself is the really the most tricky one to get your head around because there's a lot of difficult situations that are going on in between the two people that it's really difficult to just boil it down to its essence and understand it.
Well, I mean, no offense to you, but women who are involved in scenarios that involve abuse of children or something like Homolka, they're very keen on, you know, absolving themselves, trying to sound like they're just a victim.
Yeah.
You know, most women who've abused their kids will gaslight the kids. They will always deny. I know someone who's going through that right now. She confronted her mother about it, and her mother completely lies and says she didn't do it. You know, there was a... Dr. Phil had this episode, it was a two-parter, but this girl, her parents basically sexually abused her and made porn videos and sold them to pedophiles, basically, when she was still a minor. And her mother, you know, totally played the victim and acted like she didn't know what she was doing. But, you know, her daughter, nobody was buying it, of course. And, but yeah, that's something a lot of women do, unfortunately. They try to deflect all accountability.
Yeah. Or they are to an extent coerced by their partner to get them, you know, young girls, or some of them will even offer up their own children. And then they will adamantly claim that, you know, he made me do it, or I did it because I was, you know, under some spell with him. And I always have such a hard time with it because I always think a mother would maybe even sacrifice themselves, you know, to please someone that they're obsessed with or whatever. But at the point where you're being asked to sacrifice your child's dignity, that would be like the place where you would think a mom or a dad would have this line that they would just go, that's just too far. I'm not, you know, and so blaming other people for it, you know, unless I'm in that situation, I don't know. I don't know if I can wrap my head around that, where it would makes reasonable sense to me. But I think people can be persuaded to do very horrible things. Women and men can be persuaded to do really horrible, unethical, terrible things they probably never would have ever dreamed that they would be involved with, just by being slowly worn down and coerced and then torn down, you know, that, you know, their self-esteem and, you know, just their even sense of reality, what's acceptable, what's not acceptable. We like to think that our ethics as well as our brains are very resilient, and, you know, they're actually very weak machines sometimes. And so I just think that it's a big topic. And so it's really hard to get your head around all of that. But I absolutely know what you're talking about when you say that, you know, the child is the victim. And when you have sometimes females coming out of a relationship where they try to make it sound like it's not their fault, it gets so hard to understand it. It's really difficult. I'm glad that I'm not the one that has to sit and work through that with people, because I just wouldn't have the patience for it.
Yeah.
The child is the victim. The child is the victim to me.
Did you ever see that Netflix series Abducted in Plain Sight?
Yeah, I think we talked about that last time.
Oh, we did talk about it last time.
Yeah, that was a pretty good example of just seeing someone who says that they're persuaded by someone, and you think, I don't believe it. I just sounds like you wanted to not believe what you were doing.
Or maybe they're just really dumb.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's that too.
Yeah. All right. Well, it looks like we can wrap things up now.
Yeah, it was a nice chat, because I'm really happy to see that this case did not just fizzle out. I was so surprised when they found out the actual identity of the young boy, and I kind of take a sort of quiet thankfulness and kind of a little bit happiness that maybe this will kind of scare some other people who think that they've gotten away with something.
And yeah,
it's interesting. The times are changing.
It's unfortunate that the perpetrators are never brought to justice, and their motives will remain in the void. And that's a part of it that'll never be resolved, I guess. But yeah. I mean, as I said, the parents would not be alive today, because Joseph would be, he's like a year younger than my mother, so he'd be like 71 or 72, I think.
Yeah, they kind of implied that his father is possibly alive. I guess because it's still an open case, it's kind of tricky the way they've worded it. They made it very clear his mother has passed,
but yeah,
it's kind of open to whether or not his father has, and he would be the one with the answers, you would think.
Well, yeah, his father would probably be almost as old as Betty White at this point.
Yeah, that's true. It's true. Yeah, like I don't know, maybe he, even since then he has passed away.
Yeah, it makes me wonder, you know, if you are sent to jail at the age of like 95, isn't it really just like going from one nursing home to another? I mean, at that point.
That's like that old bird who was, I guess she worked in one of the front offices for the Nazis. They just had her in court a couple months ago, and she's in her 90s. And I was thinking, yeah, what are you going to do with her? Like,
oh, well, she was part of the Third Reich. Like,
yeah. And she offered to help. She applied for the job. She was all about it. And so it's horrible, horrible woman, but she's, you know, pretty old. She's almost 100 years old.
Well, you know, the Nazis were liberal in the sense that they actually employed women in very high ranking positions. Mm-hmm. So that was one way in which they were very progressive.
Well, she was all about being progressive and joining for sure. So
Yeah.
you wonder, like, so, well, they're not going to make her serve prison time, but I think it was important to convict her, and have that, in history on the record that, she was convicted. And so, I don't know. Sometimes I kind of wish, I guess, my more morbid side, that a judge could, when shown something, beyond not even beyond a reasonable doubt, but where you have more certainty, they could just pull a gun from under their desk and shoot
Yeah.
people.
Yeah.
Especially people who abuse children and stuff like that. But I've just seen too many cases where very compelling evidence, where I am 100% believing that, justice was served. And then I find out later that actually there is this whole other mountain of information I wasn't aware of. And, just because of that, it makes me just feel like a little more cautious about things like the death penalty.
Yeah.
Some pretty bad examples of things that have happened, but.
Well, unfortunately, the system is not oriented enough toward prevention when it comes to those crimes. There's only one clinic in the entire world where mental health professionals help pedophiles to refrain from offending. And I don't know if for some reason people are against that here. But the thing is, yes, you can prosecute a pedophile, you can keep ramping up the legal penalties, but it doesn't
It
change the
doesn't help.
fact that it can't undo the damage that's
That's
been
right.
done, you know?
Yeah, it's like they don't want to spend tax dollars to help someone
Yeah. But
who
it's not a
they see. They see
but the
them as, well, they're
therapy
so sick, but they
yeah
are sick.
the
They
therapy
do
the
need help.
therapy's not about it's not about being sympathetic or
No.
it's about helping them to develop techniques so that they can, you know,
They don't offend.
yeah,
Like,
it's
I don't
important.
know why someone wouldn't support that.
Yeah, I don't know,
But
people overrated things, you know.
I think I saw the same documentary that you were talking about previously, where it did seem that, for people who want to reach out for help, it's very daunting because it's terrifying
Well, yeah,
to admit.
one thing they're worried about is if they say they're a pedophile, they're worried that, you know, they'll attract attention from the police and they don't. And so they need to be able to go to a place where they can be anonymous if necessary,
That's
and
right.
people just help them and teach them, you know, how to change their thoughts so that they're not going to give in to those urges. But we won't invest in it. And there's in that documentary, I think you were thinking of Incest, a Family Tragedy. They were talking about how there's never enough funding for that kind of thing to help these people. To refrain from offending. And but I think that's an important investment because, as I said, yes, you can send somebody away to prison for years. Impose the sex offender registry on them, but that doesn't heal the victims. Prevention is what prevents the
That's
pain,
right.
you know.
Yeah, and some of them seem like desperate for that help in the
Yeah.
sense that they don't want to offend. They want to live a life of never hurting another person. They don't desire to hurt a child, but they have to reconcile these weird impulses that they have. And it just seems to me that the best thing you could do is give them the proper help. But it's like they haven't broken a law, they haven't, acted on anything, but the idea to come forward and ask for the help is so terrifying. And we don't even have the help to give them if they did. So it's
Yeah.
pretty dire consequence of that. So
It's a valuable public service to help someone to prevent
yes.
from sexually abusing children. That's an important
Absolutely.
thing. Well, on that note, I think
On that happy note, I'm going to
yeah.
talk to you again.
I'm uplifting, yeah.
Anyways, it was really nice chatting with you.
Yeah, nice chatting
Yeah.
with you, yeah.
All right, have a great night.
Yeah, you too. Take care.
Okay, take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye.